Chapter 46. The world on which the council looked did indeed present a task quite sufficiently immense, and altogether too urgent for any wanton indulgence in internal dissension. It may be interesting to sketch in a few phrases the condition of mankind at the close of the period of warring states, in the year of crisis, that followed the release of atomic power. It was a world extraordinarily limited, when one measures it by later standards, and it was now in a state of the direst confusion and distress. It must be remembered that at this time men had still to spread into enormous areas of the land surface of the globe. There were vast mountain wildernesses, forest wildernesses, sandy deserts, and frozen lands. Men still clung closely to water and arable soil in temperate or subtropical climates. They lived abundantly only in river valleys, and all their great cities had grown upon large navigable rivers or close to ports upon the sea. Over great areas even of this suitable land, flies and mosquitoes, armed with infection, had so far defeated human invasion, and under their protection the virgin forests remained untouched. Indeed, the whole world even in its most crowded districts was filthy with flies and swarming with needless insect life to an extent which is now almost incredible. A population map of the world in 1950 would have followed seashore and river course so closely in its darker shading as to give an impression that Homo sapiens was an amphibious animal. His roads and railways lay also along the lower contours, only here and there to pierce some mountain barrier, or reach some holiday resort did they clamber above 3,000 feet. And across the ocean his traffic passed in definite lines. There were hundreds of thousands of square miles of ocean no ship ever traversed except by mischance. Into the mysteries of the solid globe under his feet he had not yet pierced 4 or 5 miles, and it was still not 40 years since, with a tragic pertinacity, he had clambered to the poles of the earth. The limitless mineral wealth of the Arctic and Antarctic circles was still buried beneath vast accumulations of immemorial ice, and the secret riches of the inner zones of the crust were untapped and indeed unsuspected. The higher mountain regions were known only to a sprinkling of guide-led climbers, and the frequenters of a few gaunt hotels, and the vast rainless belts of land that lay across the continental masses, from Gobi to Sahara, and along the backbone of America, with their perfect air, their daily baths of blazing sunshine, their nights of cool serenity and glowing stars, and their reservoirs of deep-lying water, were as yet only desolations of fear and death to the common imagination. And now under the shock of the atomic bombs, the great masses of population which had gathered into the enormous dingy town centers of that period were dispossessed, and scattered disastrously over the surrounding rural areas. It was as if some brutal force, grown impatient at last at man's blindness, had with the deliberate intention of a rearrangement of population upon more wholesome lines, shaken the world. The great industrial regions and the large cities that had escaped the bombs were, because of their complete economic collapse, in almost as tragic plight as those that blazed, and the countryside was disordered by a multitude of wandering and lawless strangers. In some parts of the world famine raged, and in many regions there was plague. The plains of North India, which had become more and more dependent for the general welfare on the railways, and that great system of irrigation canals which the malignant chapter of the Patriots had destroyed, were in a state of peculiar distress. Whole villages lay dead together, no man eating, and the very tigers and panthers that preyed upon the emaciated survivors crawled back infected into the jungle to perish. Large areas of China were a prey to brigand bands. It is a remarkable thing that no complete contemporary account of the explosion of the atomic bomb survives. There are, of course, innumerable allusions and partial records, and it is from these that subsequent ages must piece together the image of these devastations. The phenomena, it must be remembered, changed greatly from day to day, and even from hour to hour, as the exploding bomb shifted its position, threw off fragments, or came into contact with water, or a fresh texture of soil. Barnett, who came within 40 miles of Paris early in October, is concerned chiefly with his account of the social confusion of the countryside, and the problems of his command, but he speaks of heaped cloud masses of steam all along the sky to the southwest, and of a red glare beneath these at night. Parts of Paris were still burning, and numbers of people were camped in the fields even at this distance watching over treasured heaps of salvaged loot. He speaks too of the distant rumbling of the explosion like trains going over iron bridges. Other descriptions agree with this. They all speak of the continuous reverberations, of the thudding and hammering, or some such phrase, and they all testify to a huge pall of steam, from which rain would fall suddenly in torrents, and amidst which lightning played. Drawing nearer to Paris, an observer would have found the salvage camps increasing in number and blocking up the villages, and large numbers of people, often starving and ailing, camping under improvised tents, because there was no place for them to go. The sky became more and more densely overcast until at last it blotted out the light of day, and left nothing but a dull red glare extraordinarily depressing to the spirit. In this dull glare, great numbers of people were still living, clinging to their houses and in many cases subsisting in a state of partial famine upon the produce in their gardens, and the stores in the shops of the provision dealers. Coming in still closer, the investigator would have reached the police cordon, which was trying to check the desperate enterprise of those who would return to their homes, or rescue their more valuable possessions within the zone of imminent danger. That zone was rather arbitrarily defined. If our spectator could have got permission to enter it, he would have entered also a zone of uproar, a zone of perpetual thunderings, lit by a strange purplish red light, and quivering and swaying with the incessant explosion of the radioactive substance. Whole blocks of buildings were alight and burning fiercely, the trembling, ragged flames looking pale and ghastly, and attenuated in comparison with the full-bodied crimson glare beyond. The shells of other edifices already burnt rose, pierced by rows of window sockets against the red-lit mist. Every step farther would have been as dangerous as a descent within the crater of an active volcano. These spinning, boiling bomb centers would shift, or break unexpectedly into new regions, great fragments of earth or drain or masonry suddenly caught by a jet of disruptive force, might come flying by the explorer's head, or the ground yawn a fiery grave beneath his feet. Few who adventured into these areas of destruction, and survived attempted any repetition of their experiences. There are stories of puffs of luminous, radioactive vapor drifting sometimes scores of miles from the bomb center and killing and scorching all they overtook. And the first conflagrations from the Paris center spread westward halfway to the sea. Moreover, the air in this infernal inner circle of red-lit ruins had a peculiar dryness and a blistering quality, so that it set up a soreness of the skin and lungs that was very difficult to heal. Such was the last state of Paris, and such on a larger scale was the condition of affairs in Chicago, and the same fate had overtaken Berlin, Moscow, Tokyo, the eastern half of London, Toulon, Kiel, and 218 other centers of population or armament. Each was a flaming center of radiant destruction, that only time could quench, that indeed in many instances time has still to quench. To this day, though indeed with a constantly diminishing uproar and vigor, these explosions continue. In the map of nearly every country of the world, three or four or more red circles, a score of miles in diameter, mark the position of the dying atomic bombs and the death areas that men have been forced to abandon around them. Within these areas perished museums, cathedrals, palaces, libraries, galleries of masterpieces, and a vast accumulation of human achievement, whose charred remains lie buried, a legacy of curious material that only future generations may hope to examine. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.